to get a fuller picture, we should turn from this passage. As I said, you want to look this up. If you look this up in a concordance, what concordance? I suggest that the Englishman's Hebrew concordance. The Englishman's Hebrew concordance will tell you all the places where this word shagag is used. Now, there's a word shagag and the word shagah.
Apparently means to go astray. It's used of going astray like a sheep. A sheep goes astray. And apparently it means sin in that sense of not willful, intentional, or ignorant, but just wandering off. Neglect, perhaps, might be the emphasis of this kind of sin. But the thing becomes more complicated when you look over in Numbers. And if you just take Numbers 15 in your English, turn to Numbers 15 in the English. It would be worthwhile to
translated, but you don't need to. It's sufficient.
Numbers 15 in the English, beginning at verse 22. It's called offerings, now I'm following the NIV. Offerings for unintentional sins. Let me read some, and you follow. If you unintentionally fail to keep any of these commandments, the word is shagag, the Lord gave Moses, any of the Lord's commands from the day the Lord gave them, 24, and if this is done unintentionally, this is lishgaga, unintentionally, without the community being aware of it, then the whole community is to offer a young bull for a burnt offering, and so on. And verse 25, the priest is to make atonement for the whole Israelite community to be forgiven, for it was not intentional. It was shugaga. It was unintentional. They brought to the Lord for their wrong. Now, their wrong there is vishagaga. Now, there it is just plain, they brought for their wrong an offering made by fire and a sin offering. And holy Israelite community, aliens living among them, be forgiven because all the people were involved in the vishagaga, in the unintentional wrong. But if one person sins unintentionally, this is bishagaga, he must bring a year-old female goat, and so on. But verse 30, that anyone who sins defiantly, whether native-born or alien, blasphemes the Lord, and that person must be cut off from his people because he has despised the Lord. Now, it looks as if unintentional sins you can sacrifice for. But in verse 30, the King James says, anyone who sins presumptuously, I think. Anyone who sins presumptuously, native-born or alien, blasphemes the Lord. There is no sacrifice for the defiant sin. The Hebrew is sin with a high hand. Now, that's an expression. What does it mean? Sin with a high hand. Deliberate, intentional, flagrant. Yeah, that sin, there is no sacrifice for that sin. But there is a sacrifice for the unintentional sin.
Well, how about the sins that are neither one? See,
there are a lot of sins that are not defiant, but just, say white lie, there are sins that are, we all sin, daily in thought, word, and deed. And sometimes on purpose, and sometimes by accident, sometimes by omission, sins of omission. Is there no sacrifice for them in the Old Testament time? That would be a dangerous view to take. What the NIV said was that the contrast is not between intentional and unintentional. The contrast is between the defiant sin and the others.
And you know, in the New Testament, you have also some sins that you can't get rid of. What are they?
Blasphemy against the Holy Spirit, what we call the unforgivable sins. There are unforgivable sins. There are sins against light. There are purposive sins in serious matters. And there comes a day when God gives up. Of course, you know that some people are concerned because they may have forgiven, they may have done the unforgivable sin and their guilt, bad conscience. Mostly, if a person is concerned, what he has not done the unforgivable sin. Encourage him that way. But I would argue that the contrast in here is not unintentional versus purposive, but is defiant versus, shall we say, ordinary sin, and that the word bishagaga means a sin in which he goes astray, a waywardness, one of the other sins, but not necessarily unintentional. Now, I say that partly because chapter 6, verse 1. Now, you read chapter 6, verse 1 of Leviticus, back to Leviticus. Here it says, if anyone sins and is unfaithful to the Lord by deceiving his neighbor about something entrusted to him or left in his care or stolen or he cheats him, or if he finds lost property and lies about it, if he swears falsely, if he commits any such sin that people may do,
when he thus sins and becomes guilty, he must return what was stolen, add 20%, and bring it to the priest, and the priest will make atonement. Now, these sins are intentional. You might call them minor, call any sin minor. You might call them minor, but they are intentional. But there is salvation. There is a sacrifice for such sins, even though they are intentional. So I say the contrast is, you cannot say, as the man said last night, there is no sacrifice for intentional sin. Plainly, this sacrifice, this asham, is for some intentional sin. Not hardened sinner, not a defiant sinner, but a person who is weak and he does something wrong and confesses. For him, there is a sin offering, and that's the sin offering. Now, is that clear? Then, of course, I try to get a little bit farther. What is the Shigaga? And now here's a further point. I think, now I'm just kind of toying with this idea, not sure about this, but I think the Shigaga is specifically a sin in connection with worship. Now see, chapter 6 tells about lying and cheating your neighbor. But chapter, where we are, verse 14, is you read, Mr. Kim, you read, if it is done with regard to one of the holy things. If a Shigaga is going astray in matters of worship, you don't bring your tithe. You took the name of the Lord in vain. You spoke against the priest or any of several things. Maybe you didn't come to the three annual festivals for 2 years. You know, there's a lot of things you could do with regard to the ritual and worship of the temple. And that, I think, in this section of Leviticus, the Shigaga is limited somehow to the holy thing. And doesn't have anything to do with this problem of intentional versus unforgivable. The intentional sin is given back in chapter 4. Now, we didn't do chapter 4. It doesn't specify in chapter 4. It says, does what is forbidden in any of the Lord's commands. Very first verse. Say to the Israelites, when anyone sins unintentionally, that's Shigaga, that's Bishigaga, from Shagag, then this is a sin offering here, Chatat, but he must bring it, confess it before the priest and so on. And verse 13, if the whole Israelite community sins this way, but the thing is not specified what it is. In verse 22, when a leader sins this way. Verse 27, if a member of the community sins this way, in any of the Lord's commands. Now, is the Lord's commands the Ten Commandments, or are they specifically commandments about the worship of the tabernacle? In chapter 5, 14 and following, it seems to be religious matters where they sin. And I would suggest that Shigaga is primarily that. Now, I don't know that I can prove that, but I think it would fit the whole picture a little bit better. And it is used in with regard to Chatat. It is used, I think, also with regard to, I guess it's not used. Yes, it's used with regard to the Asham as well as the Chatat. The Chatat, the sin offering, and Asham, the guilt offering. It is used with regard to both. Again, with regard to the guilt offering, he is to bring something in addition, a fine, and 1/5 extra, 20% more.
How did you translate Shigaga?
That's the question.
My question, you're in.
You got me, yeah.
What did you argue for?
We translated the word in verse 18. We translated it wrong. atonement for him for the wrong he has committed unintentionally. I would say probably commits a violation and sins, not ignorance, unwittingly is perhaps not a bad, not unintentionally, but unwittingly, accidentally. It's used, for instance, when you touch a dead body, accidentally. I don't think there is one, say there's no one answer. Depend on your context. Accidentally sometimes, but I hesitate to say ignorance. I think I would say unwittingly more than that. But I would emphasize in regard to the holy things, in regard to the Lord's holy things. Well, you see, here is an exegetical problem, and it's not an easy problem. And you get it by consideration of what it's talking about, the context. And you go after it also by the usage of the verb in other places. I think I was a shagaga, mistake or error, in some places I think would fit well. Of course, mistake I think did fit very well back in Genesis. Makes a mistake in sin, might not be too bad. Well, the rest of this, I think, is not so difficult, but that is a real problem, and you see some of the problems and maybe some suggestions of the answer. So, shall we go on now and see, Mr. Kim, you did 14 and 15, didn't you? And Sunmun, Kim? You take 16 then?
And which is sin against the holy things? Who shall atone?
Atone? This is Yeshalem. Yeshalem. I question atone for that. Maybe a broad use of that. Go ahead. Yes. Yes, we would say pay for it. He shall pay back. Yes. Yes. Yes, now put yourself there. Suppose you had done it. How would you do this now? You had sinned against the tabernacle. Maybe you had... not been careful, and you had backed your car over the stakes in the tabernacle and torn up a curtain. And it cost 40 shekels to fix the curtain, you see. Now, here would be a sin against the tabernacle. It would be a mistake that you had done against one of the Lord's holy things. So the first thing you would have to do would be to pay 40 shekels for a new curtain. And then, so that's restitution. I see, if you stole something from a neighbor, the restitution would be to give it back to the neighbor. But here, suppose instead of hurting a curtain, suppose you had brought moldy bread for your offering, and the bread was no good. And maybe you didn't know it, maybe you thought it might do, and there was 2 shekels worth of bread. 10 shekels worth of bread. You see, there's a restitution that is needed. This is restitution to the tabernacle, to the priesthood. Wherever it should have gone, you must do it. I see, this is the difference between the asham. This is the asham. The chatat, you can't do that. If you sin because in your mind you have called the priest a dummy, you can't bring any fine for that, see. That's a chatat. This is an asham. See the difference? Yes, but...
This difference is consistent in all the contexts of the Old
Testament. You know, there isn't the detail given in the book of Samuel. You don't find this detail given in Isaiah. This is the book where you find that sort of thing. These are the rules for the priests. I think it's consistent here, but in lots of other places it is not. It doesn't come up. But even the words are interchangeable right here, but that there are two different kinds of circumstance, I think, that you couldn't prove otherwise elsewhere, and you can prove it here. So I think to that extent it's consistent. Yes, and the fifth part, that's add 20%. If you had caused the curtain here, the curtain had been torn, you had to get a new curtain, cost 40 shekels, well, you would give short 40 shekels plus eight more, wouldn't you? And that's, we would call that a fine. And this fine, a restitution, add to it. And give it to the priest. And then the next, finish it up. Yeah, with an asham ram. An asham ram, the sacrifice of a ram, which is an asham sacrifice. A guilt offering, yes. The ram for a guilt offering. Nishlak lo. Salak, to forgive. Yes. What form would this like? Nifal is right, passing. He shall be forgiven. It shall be forgiven to him. Yes, that's right. This is it, Hashem. Here's the situation for individual. Okay, the next Mr. Labs? No, he's not here yet. Yes. Okay, go ahead.
The nature of that forgiveness in relation to what is said in Hebrews 10:4. There's blood of bulls and rams, do not in the way of sin.
Does Hebrews say that? But does Leviticus say that they do?
Yeah, they do. That's the point I'm getting at.
Oh, that's
yeah,
the
you
point.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay, now what's the answer?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, as far as this is...
You all see the question. It says it shall be forgiven. Book of Hebrews says the blood of bulls and goats can't take away sin. I'll ask you a further question. Did the people in ancient times think that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sin? Oh?
I think so.
Oh?
I think they, when they offered, uh-huh. these people, uh-huh. the Jews, when they offered a sacrifice, I think they felt forgiven uh-huh. and thought they were forgiven.
Yeah.
Maybe not ultimately.
Well, that's not what I asked. Okay. I think they thought they were forgiven too. I think they were forgiven. But did they think they were forgiven on the basis of the blood of bulls and goats? That's the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
See it? That's the question. Was the blood of bulls and goats operative, effective in ancient times? Or was it symbolic and meaningful and sacramental in ancient times? Isn't that the question?
Or may I ask another question?
Yes.
Could it be that we're talking about a different kind of sin here?
Well, we're talking about lying and cheating here. Yeah? No, we're talking about sin. I think the sins of ancient times are remarkably like the sins of today. I hesitate to say which is worse. But, this is a real question now. How much, here it comes down to this, how much did the ancient Jews know about what they were doing? What did Abraham think? I'm interested more than in Hebrew grammar here, and maybe I'll take off on what Abraham thought and see if I can help here, because it's just a pretty basic question. When Moses came down from the mountain, he said to God, "Oh Lord, these people have sinned a great sin. Yet now forgive their sin." Remember what he says in about Exodus 32, is it? He says, "And if not, blot my name out of the book you have written. Remember that? God said no. God said no. I will, but these people must be punished. Paul in Romans 9, wasn't it? In Romans 9, I think Paul says 10, I guess. I could wish that I were accursed from God for my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh. God didn't do that, did he? God didn't take Paul instead of the Jews, right? Let me ask a further question. The king of Moab, when he was besieged by the Israelites all around and was about to be killed, remember, he brought his son out on the ramparts and offered up his son as a sacrifice. Remember that? Why did he do that? It was crisis, wasn't it? And in this crisis, he had the idea that if he would give his son, maybe the God would be accepted, that he would be accepted before the God. Human sacrifice, in one way you look at it, is very terrible. But if you look at it another way, it is very noble. Isn't that right? Think of the boy. Think of the son of the king of Moab. What was he doing? He was offering himself to save his people. What do you call that? Hero, don't you? Here he was offering himself, the best that he had, his own blood, to save himself and his nation from these invaders. This human sacrifice, I think we ought to think pretty carefully about it. It was, as I say, awful. In some ways it was awful because it was children. They were just unwanted children or something. But there were times when in nobility a person would offer himself or his son, his chief, best, in order to gain the favor of the deity. What's wrong with that? No, there's anything wrong with it. One thing wrong with it is it's not enough. Is that right? It's not enough. Now, whom are you thinking of when I say all this about human sacrifice in the Old Testament? What's your best example? Isaac and Abraham. Now, the Bible doesn't say much about Isaac. The Lord told Abraham, go sacrifice your son. Now, people say that here was the God of the Old Testament, a bloodthirsty deity, asking for blood, you know. Søren Kierkegaard is famous for his essay on this. He says how here this was irrational. God told Abraham to do what God had told Abraham not to do. You shall not kill. You shall kill your son, and you believe in an irrational deity, and this is existentialism. Kierkegaard. I look at that somewhat differently. Abraham was told by God to, in some crisis that we don't know about, in some crisis, he was told by God to offer his son, and Abraham was willing to offer his son. And don't forget, Isaac was willing to be offered. The real hero there is Isaac. He was a young fellow, a teenager. He could get away from the old man very easy if he wanted to. But Isaac let himself be bound on the altar in order to placate the deity. But what was wrong with that? Was it because of this awful statement of Abraham? No. What's wrong with it wasn't good enough. Isn't that right? Like Moses, like Paul, Isaac was not good enough, and Abraham must see that. And God said to Abraham, lay not thy hand on the son. Abraham said, God will provide a sacrifice. But God will provide a sacrifice that was good enough. And all of these sacrifices here, you come across the word, tamim, right? Tamim. It must be good enough. The child is not good enough. He's not perfect. None of us are perfect. The animal is only an animal
but it is symbolic of perfection. And I believe that God told Abraham a great lesson that day. And Abraham saw. The Pharisees saw two sacrifices twice as good as one sacrifice. That's legalism. But the person who sacrificed in faith realized that this was symbolic. And God would make the atonement. The priest, in the name of God, he would make the atonement, but not on the basis of the blood of bulls and goats. So I would say that Hebrews is not against the Old Testament, but is fairly translating the Old, interpreting the Old Testament. And it was the Old Testament was forgiven. There was forgiveness. They had the confidence of forgiveness. They could sing the Psalms as well as we can. But they realized that forgiveness was from God, not from extra sacrifices. If they had multitudinous sacrifices, it was for fellowship. One burnt offering was enough for the whole nation every day, morning, one night. So that's a good question, and it's a deep question. And it's an old question, but if you take the Bible as a whole, and even if you take the Old Testament, I think it's clear. The Old Testament was a heart religion. Don't forget it. In Deuteronomy it says, if you, Deuteronomy, what is it, 10, also 30, if you obey, the Lord will circumcise your hearts. They were not saved by circumcision. They were not saved by sacrifice. The Lord will circumcise your hearts. Hearts of your children. Jeremiah picked it up in the New Testament. It says the same thing. Not a Jew is one outwardly. A Jew is one inwardly. Circumcision must be of the heart, said Paul. And in that he quotes Jeremiah and Deuteronomy. One other good example of that, and that is in Hezekiah. Hezekiah's Passover. I think we mentioned it last time. Hezekiah's Passover. It was a month late. Some people did it who were not ready. Hezekiah said, the good Lord pardon everyone who prepares his heart to seek the Lord. Old Testament religion was a heart religion. And these were symbols, sacraments, meaningful. And when they were brought in faith, the priest gave atonement and he was forgiven. Nislak. It's a good word. Precious word. Nislak lo. It shall be forgiven. So the sacrifices, as I say, the Hebrew is important, but we want to get what it means. Well, it's time for us to stop. And again, we haven't finished Hebrew. You're responsible for this Hebrew.
And maybe I should go over and just read something to you.